From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is The Televisionaries. Today, we're returning to the rebooted world of Big Brother. We discuss the hot topic of the moment, the cancel culture sparked by the Black Lives Matter movement, and we're dusting off our shoulder pads, spraying ourselves with a bottle of Forever Crystal perfume, and catching up with one of the highest rating shows of the 1980s, Dynasty. Here with me today are my fellow housemates from the Herald and the Age newsrooms, guide and Green Guide columnist and reviewer Debbie Enker, and calling in from our LA studio is our culture editor-at-large Michael Adardo. How are you both?
Hello, very good, very good.
Very well, thanks Louise.
Very good. Today we're looking at Channel 7's rebooted version of reality competition Big Brother. At first glance, it's not a million miles from the Big Brother we saw on our screens 19 years ago, when watching someone make a sandwich live on TV was groundbreaking stuff. It still features a group of strangers placed in a house together, where their every move is filmed by cameras. After its first week on air, it's been crowned a rating success, with a high of 1.22 million viewers. But will its success last? There have been early claims of racism, with two of the first evictees being of Asian background, while Seven's trumpeting of diverse casting is interesting, if you consider a former AFL star diverse. Before we have a chat, let's listen to this clip, which features host Sonia Kruger preparing the housemates for their eviction votes.
Sarah and Talia, as winners of the challenge, you won the power to nominate, therefore you will not vote. Everyone else must choose to evict either Hannah, Sabong, or Marissa. Housemates, Big Brother is ready, and it's time now to evict.
Michael, what makes this Big Brother so different from the original?
We've grown up with not the actual Big Brother format. We've grown up with a slightly adjusted one. What we had for a long time was this sort of theme park crowd screaming crazy. I mean, they really built it into an event. What we have now is a sort of dial back to the American or Canadian version, which is sort of shot in a soundstage. There's no fanfare. There isn't the nation doesn't vote. Although in this one, obviously in the finale, everything flips. The viewers get to vote at that point. The key thing here is that the gameplay is exposed, which is that in previous versions, you were not allowed to talk about who you were nominating or who was being evicted. You weren't allowed to kind of play the game in a verbal sense. You had to be a bit subtle about it. That doesn't exist here. This is really kind of like watching Survivor in a house where basically all of the narrative ends up being driven by who's forming alliances, who's up for eviction, who's going to be evicted. I mean, I really actually quite like this format. I think everyone was a little nervous that it might be hard to get into or kind of hard, that it wouldn't be delivered so well. But I think also post-Married at First Sight, you know, there's the whole idea of these kind of pre-cooked reality narratives. I'm not sure you can just rely on people making a sandwich in a kitchen to kind of compel the nation. You do kind of have to construct these almost edited story threads, you know, to kind of drive it forward.
Yeah, they're not doing much, but it's edited so well that it really had me sitting on the edge of my seat. Debbie, what about you? Was it a pleasant surprise or not?
In a sense, it was an unpleasant surprise because I found myself quite engaged by it. And it has never been a format that I have been a fan of. Mm. I think that the contestants in this show are always very much feel like pawns in the producer's game. You know, there are surprises, there are secret missions, there are people being dropped in cages and sneaking in the middle of the night. I mean, I've never felt warmly about this as a format. And my memories of the earlier versions were a lot of kind of Caucasian 20-somethings cut off from the world, talking about themselves and each other incessantly. Like, I wasn't gripped by it. What I found after watching the first week, though, was that, I mean, I think because of what Michael was saying about how exposed the politics are, I started to get really engaged by it. I started off thinking Angela is really annoying me, but by the end of the week I was quite charmed by her. I couldn't, you know, I was horrified by Kieran's duplicity when he went to another alliance and revealed the plots of the people he was, you know, he'd teamed up with. Oh, Kieran, what are you doing? And I thought, how engaged in this am I? So in answer to your question, I was surprised by it, and the new tweaks have worked for me in terms of keeping me engaged in it.
Mm. Do you think it's diverse enough?
No, I think there's. I do think there's a problem, but I think the diversity issue sort of lives on two layers. What the first week kind of showed us was there was a racial knockdown. The first three evictees were all non-white contestants. That's just a reality. And I think what people see when they criticise that is that that people in the house are making a sort of subconsciously racist decision to eject everyone who's non-white. I'm not 100% sure that's exactly what's happening. What I think is actually happening, I think happens on a more complex level, which is that it's not the house that's the problem or whatever you might imagine the subconscious prejudices of the housemates. I actually think the problem lies in the casting, which is that, you know, so the Asian guy gets evicted because he's annoying. But why does the casting process only put an annoying Asian guy into the house? And I feel like that's actually where the real kind of damage is done and where the real repair needs to happen is that at a casting level, it's not just about diversity in terms of lots of different looking faces. It's about remembering that, you know, people of colour shouldn't always be victims or villains. They need to be heroes within the narrative. And that's not something the housemates can fix, and it's not something the contestants can fix. That lives entirely in the casting.
I completely agree with you because I think Alan was set up early on to be the villain. He was unbelievably arrogant. He spoke about himself in the third person, which is never a good thing. And he was convinced he was going to win. The way that he was presented to viewers and possibly the way he presented himself to the other housemates was that you disliked him intensely immediately.
Completely.
I mean, you see him talking about, you know, his mother cooks for him, his grandmother cleans for him, he's
all
lifting his feet at home when he's being vacuumed around.
And that package was shot as a noose. Like, this whole package has been engineered to make the audience loathe this guy.
Yeah, and when Subong came in, he was immediately perceived by the other men as a threat, and he showed with them how he could do push-ups with one hand on his fingertips and toes, and they looked at him and went, this guy's trouble. They cast someone maybe with a Korean background who they thought would present like that when he arrived in the house, and that's exactly what happened.
The storylines they're setting up, especially the one, the Subong episode, was very much men threatened by another strong male, whereas the women were threatened by a pretty younger woman. It was just like, oh, it's all a bit boring. Is that all you've got for us? It's just like the law of the jungle. Okay, guys don't like strong men. Girls don't like pretty young thing. Let's just move on. It's like, I wanted something a little bit more interesting.
The other thing I would add too is I think that for most of this format's life, Gretel Colleen was the host. Sonia Kruger is a very different host. Sonia's like a sort of a straight entertainment reporter. Gretel, I actually think, played it much more like a lab experiment, over-intellectualizing a relatively simple format. And actually, for the first time, the format's complexity and the gameplay has evolved. But actually, what's kind of missing is that kind of the intellectualism that I think Gretel brought to analysing it. There was just something about that that actually, I just think this show would actually be better served by the kind of post-show analysis that she did.
Yeah, and I find the questioning of the people who have been nominated to be evicted to be really, it's painful to watch. It's that, you know, now why do you think you've been chosen? And how are you feeling at the moment? It's stretching out their agony, and I find that it seems unfair to them. It makes me again think of them as poor creatures in a science experiment.
Yeah, but they did volunteer to go in. Let's not forget.
They
know what they're up for.
Kills me actually particularly is that when these shows happen and someone comes off the show and goes, oh, they framed me in the I'm not a villain. Oh, the editing. I'm like, please, anyone laboring under the misapprehension that a reality television program for exploitation and entertainment is going to portray them in a positive or in any light other than the one that serves the show. Is kidding themselves.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you mentioned exploitation, Michael, because Big Brother was launched at a really interesting time. We've mentioned the diversity issue of the show, and these past couple of weeks we've seen some pretty interesting stuff going on in terms of rethinking what is and isn't acceptable on television. The Black Lives Matter protests have resulted in shows like Fawlty Towers, Little Britain, The Mighty Boosh, and Chris Lilley shows, We Could Be Heroes, Summer Heights High, and Jonah from Tonga, all pulled from broadcast because they contain racial slurs or blackface. Some say it's censorship, while others think it's the right thing to do. Michael, you wrote about this during the week for the paper. How do you view what's happened in the last week?
I think the first thing that the discussion has to be prefaced with is that almost everything that's been, quote, cancelled, unquote, hasn't really been, quote, cancelled, unquote. Mm. Gone with the Wind was taken off HBO Max in America. That's one platform of many on which it's carried. It'll be back on the platform this week. It will have historical context appended to it. One episode with Fawlty Towers was taken off one UK platform. It's also going to be back on that platform. Gone with the Wind isn't, you know, it's an 80-year-old film and it begs for context. The centre of it, I think, is Little Britain and the Chris Lilley comedies, because they actually have blackface in them. Now, to sort of understand why they have blackface in them, this is not a defence of them. What all those shows have in common is they are the one actor plays all the part sketch comedy. In a Chris Lilley show, Chris Lilley plays everybody. That's the point of the show. Little Britain, David and Matt play everybody. So inevitably in the making of those shows, a decision has been made to play multiple ethnicities, which is, I'm only saying that because I think it sort of explains why the why don't we just hire an actor of colour approach. Well, you can't really, because it's a Chris Lilley show. He either plays it or he doesn't.
But he's made a choice too. That's the thing. He's made a choice to write those characters for him to play.
Totally. I have actually over the years defended Jonah from Tonga because I kind of felt like the performance was nuanced, and that as it can in its narrative, the way it ended, very moving. But I have to bear in mind, my lens is a white lens, and if the performance offends people of colour, I have to listen to them and I have to try to understand why. So actually in the past couple of years, I've kind of gone from defending Jonah to not defending Jonah. I have to completely accept that it's offensive to people of colour, and that I have to put my hand up and say I have no problem with those shows going and not returning.
Debbie, do you think Chris Lilley's comedy should be taken down because they were more recent and should have known better? I mean, there's no defence to it, as much as there is with, say, Gone with the Wind, where it was made in a time when values were different.
I think we're living in really volatile times. You know, injustices that are happening, events that are rocking the United States and affecting the world every day. We've seen the incredible Black Lives Matter demonstrations here in the middle of a pandemic because people feel so strongly about the issue. And I think what we're seeing in response is a lot of hasty and reactive knee-jerk decision making. It's not terribly well considered. Sometimes its basis is commercial rather than ethical, and we're very quickly seeing a lot of those decisions reversed.
Yeah. The whole cancel culture debate, it's just an easy route to belittle something much more significant that's going on. And I actually think once we're through the next couple of weeks and we look back on what just happened, I actually think the so-called noble act of saving us all from Gone with the Wind actually probably vandalised the important political and cultural and social thought that goes with the black. Yeah, it's clumsy. It seems like the right thing to do. I don't think in the end you achieve anything, because in practical terms, it doesn't go away. I mean, it still exists on DVD. It still exists on digital formats. You can still, everything that's quote banned, unquote, you can still get.
Yeah, so I suppose the question is now, I mean, what do we do next? Do we put a warning on TV shows or something like that? Do we need to hear from Chris Lilley? I mean, I kind of think that maybe it'd be one step would be to just give people of colour more opportunity to have their own shows so we can hear their stories, their voices. That's the best way forward.
I don't even believe in the word warning. I'm not sure that warning is a healthy thing either. I think at the end of the day it's art. I mean, it's going to offend some
explainer?
People. It's not going to offend others. No, but that's it. I think context is everything.
Explainer.
I think when HBO Max returns Gone with the Wind, essentially what it's going to have appended to the front of it is an introduction by a history professor, I think. Like somebody who's able to say, these are things you need to understand about what you're about to see. If you look at Disney Plus, they have some very outdated animation from the Disney archive on that platform. It comes with warnings saying that these programs were made in a different time and in a different context. I even saw on BritBox, which is an American platform, an episode of Are You Being Served, as silly as it is, in which Mrs. Slocum makes a kind of uses a racist term about somebody. That came with a warning at the beginning. So this episode was produced at this time in this context. It contains material that will offend some viewers. So its context is everything. Just give people information.
I think the possibility of Chris Lilley trying to explain his work is probably zero. He's always been incredibly private, and I think he's one of those artists who thinks the work will speak for itself or not. And I think that idea of having someone explaining to you at the beginning of watching Gone with the Wind or the Germans episode of Fawlty Towers that you need to be careful strikes me like those interminable DVD extras with people earnestly doing analysis, which I would fast forward through in an instant because I don't necessarily want to be patronised like that. Yeah. They are reflective of their time and they're reflective of the views of the people who made them and starred in them. If you can make a decision not to watch it, you can object to it, you can write to the people who made it, you can voice your objections on social media. But a lot of these things, unless they're offensive or racist and then they're covered by law, have a right to exist in their own domain. And I don't like this whole nanny state, oh, we need to explain it to everyone.
Yeah, I agree. Well, let's leave that there. Let's stick around for round one of our game time. And later on in the show, we'll look back at Dynasty. We'll also check in with what our critics are binging when they're off duty. If you're enjoying this podcast, make sure to check out another new podcast from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. It's called Good Weekend Talks, and each week you can listen to a full read-through of its most popular cover stories, from inside Scott Morrison's Pentecostal church to the Spanish flu. Were we ready for another pandemic? You can listen to the definitive stories that matter to Australians. So after this episode, go and search Good Weekend Talks. Today we're playing Mastermind, and for a change, I'm handing the quiz cards over to Debbie, who's going to put me and Michael through our paces this week. Debbie, over to you.
Look, I'm delighted to assume the role of quiz mistress for a change. It's really nice to be kind of on the other side of the microphone. I don't know if you can hear the relief in my voice, but, you know, it's there, baby. It is there. So today's game is Mastermind. It's a game where contestants are quizzed on a topic of their choosing. Louise goes first because she's this week's challenger and she's chosen Parks and Recreation. Are you ready, Louise?
I'm ready.
Question one. Parks and Recreation is an American political satire sitcom starring Amy Poehler as Leslie Knope, a perky mid-level bureaucrat in the Parks Department of Pawnee, a fictional town of which US state?
Easy, Indiana.
Well done, Louise. Correct. Question two. Why was Leslie Knope born in Eagleton and not in Pawnee?
So Eagleton is Pawnee's rival town. It's a much more upper class town. And the reason that was because there were raccoons in Pawnee's hospital. So that's why Leslie's mum couldn't get over the border.
Well done, Louise. Next question. Aziz Ansari plays a sarcastic, underachieving government official who changes his name in order to succeed in politics. What is Thomas Montgomery Haverford's real name?
Oh my God. I have absolutely no idea.
His real name is Darwish Sabir Ismail Ghani. Apparently, Aziz Ansari named the character after his cousin.
Okay.
Question four. Ben Wyatt, played by Adam Scott, loves board games. What board game does he insist on playing as part of his stag night? Before Chris insists that each of the attendees name and act out their own fantasy stag night activity.
Is it the Settlers of Catan?
It is correct.
There we go.
Well done.
He loves his nerd stuff, Ben.
Next question. Who is Leslie's biggest crush?
Is it Joe Biden?
It is. Yes. Correct.
Yes, she has his frame photo everywhere and she dies when she goes to meet him in the White House. Ugh.
Well done.
Thank you. Now, I'm going to admit that I'm well out of my depth for today's back catalogue because I am too young to remember seeing it on TV. But today we're looking at Dynasty, the classic 1980s soap about the wealthy Carrington family that was driven by the ongoing feud between its two leading ladies, Crystal, played by Linda Evans, and Alexis, played by the evergreen Joan Collins. It premiered in 1981 and ran for 9 seasons, becoming just as famous for its outrageous storylines, which included incest, murder, face-changing plastic surgery, a Game of Thrones-style massacre at a wedding, and its epic catfights, as it did for having an openly gay character and for casting the first black woman to appear in a nighttime soap. At its peak, it was the number one show in the US with an audience of 23 million and a line of merchandise that included everything from $3 pantyhose to a $200,000 chinchilla coat. Unfortunately, it's not screening on any channels at the moment, but you can catch its modern-day reboot on Netflix. Before we jump in, let's listen to this clip, which features Linda Evans and Joan Collins in their first meeting in season two.
But my business is to protect my husband. His peace of mind, for one thing. I don't have to tell you what he's been through.
That man murdered my son's, his son's best friend. You don't have to tell anyone, Mrs. Jennings. Oh, I'm terribly sorry. That was your other husband's name, wasn't it? I mean, Mrs. Carrington.
I want you out of our house. You're not welcome here. And since you're so familiar with it, the kitchen, the paintings, the missing Ming, I'm sure you can find your own way to the door.
Michael, do you have the missing Ming?
No, but I can tell you that at the time that Alexis inquired about the whereabouts of the missing Ming, Crystal and Blake had loaned it out to a museum. So the Ming wasn't missing. It was just elsewhere. What a show. What a show.
This is one of your absolute favourites, isn't it?
All time. Alongside Dark Shadows and Doctor Who, weirdly they all start with a D. No idea why. Dallas was kind of the original 80s super soap, but I think what sort of made Dynasty, and I'm going to use its correct pronunciation, lawyers, without castigating you over that small matter. I'm also going to use the word castigate, which I learned from Dynasty. What separates Dynasty from the pack, really, is scale. So Dallas was about an oil company in Texas and everyone was fighting over South Fork Ranch. Dynasty was kind of global. So like Colby Coe and Denver Carrington were at war over South China Sea oil leases. Alexis had an affair with Rashid Ahmed, who was an Arab sheikh. It was kind of like, it was the soap opera from the time when shoulder pads ruled the world. It was a masterpiece.
Debbie, were you on Team Crystal or Team Alexis?
The show really came to life when Joan Collins' Alexis arrived at the beginning of season two, I think. She was brilliantly cast. She gave it great energy. And I loved this show, perhaps not with the same level of passion as Michael. It was the era of the super soaps, and viewers were very much divided between, did you follow Dallas or did you follow Dynasty? I'll have to call it Dynasty because that's what I've always called it. This show was just so brilliantly over the top. It was so well cast. It was so much fun to see this rich family constantly suffering and struggling and squabbling with each other, the scheming that went on, and the catfights. I mean, it became absolutely famous for the catfights.
They were rough.
It's an incredible show kind of to look at now. It looks very cinematic when you go back to it. It doesn't really even look contemporary, but it doesn't look dated. Michael Hugo was the cinematographer, who is an amazing talent. The Filoli Mansion is kind of where it was set. That was the Carrington Mansion, which is this incredible property in California, although the show was set in Denver. Nolan Miller did these amazing clothes. And it sort of had this scale that not a lot of shows had. I have a copy of the pilot, and one of the things on the pilot script is that it actually, the front page of the pilot script actually says, Dynasty, a novel for television. And it's sort of like, that's such a revealing sentence, I think, in terms of how it was written and what the ambition of it was to be. Even though it was a soap opera, it was kind of Shakespearean. And another thing I was kind of flicking at today to sort of get my brain around it is a book that was produced out of the show Bible by the show creator. And there's an almost kind of mythical approach to it. Like, they talk about Blake as being as handsome as a movie star in his $1,000 Brioni suit, and Crystal is described as an American Aphrodite. And the background for Alexis says, you know, she's conversant in art and ballet, and she speaks French and Spanish and Italian. And Alexis's backstory is that she went to boarding school in Switzerland but got expelled and later worked as an artist's model in Brussels. And all this sort of stuff that you think, this could be nonsense, but somehow these actors somehow just elevated this crazily into this incredible piece of art. And then, of course, that becomes an extraordinary piece of commerce. It's an incredible thing.
But it's also, watching shows today, how kind of proudly, unapologetically over the top it was. You know,
incredibly.
Everything. The costumes, Nolan Miller's costumes were amazing, but also they threw every single soap cliche at it that they could. There were, you know, illegitimate children turning up who were supposed to kids who were supposed to have been kidnapped in infancy suddenly reappeared in adulthood, half siblings, wives and lovers who disappeared or were thought dead suddenly would reemerge. And they did it without any sense of, you know, oops, is this pushing it too far? It was never too far. We loved how the excess of it was part of its appeal. And they played it so well. Mm.
Dynasty. I was always Team Bold and the Beautiful, but anyway. Let's move on to what you're watching before we get on to the second round of Game Time. Michael, what's on your box at the moment?
I kind of feel like right now I'm still sort of stumbling through a jumble of things, but what I did finally do was sit down and watch the first season of Schitt's Creek on Netflix. It's been a long time coming. Everyone's recommended it. I haven't had time. I did finally watch the first 13, and it's an incredibly sweet show.
I've seen bits of it on ABC Comedy, but
it's very good. It's essentially, it's like what would happen to the Carringtons if they lost all their money and had to move to this one little boonie town that Blake owned if all the other assets were gone. So it's about a very, very, very rich family, father, mother, son, daughter, adjusting to life with no money in a town that they own. And it's incredibly funny. It's very lovely.
Okay. Debbie, what about you?
I suspect this isn't going to interest either of you at all, but Michael in LA and Louise, you in Sydney, but I'm in Melbourne and the footy's back. This has been the first weekend of AFL, the long-delayed season, the second round. Finally, we've had a weekend of football. Not football as we knew it pre-COVID-19, but still the games are back. And Channel 7 and Foxtel have been attempting to deal with the new reality of, you know, no crowds or very few people in the stands, of commentators not sharing a booth. And it's been, you know, lovely to have the game back and interesting to watch what the broadcasters are doing to try and fill in the gaps. I think possibly the most successful thing has been the insertion of a low level of crowd noise, which you would think is going to be like sticking canned laughter on a comedy, but actually works heaps better than that. And perhaps the least successful innovation has been this mega wall thing where they're attempting to show you fans' reactions because there's no crowd to react, or very few people in crowds in South Australia and New South Wales.
It sounds like AFL Gogglebox. Is that the kind of thing it would be?
It's like this big screen that looks like a, you know, Brady Bunch credits, and people sitting around reacting when their team kicks a goal, looking kind of delighted. But it comes in too late and it doesn't convey very much excitement. So I think it's not doing what it's really supposed to be doing.
Mm. One of the great pleasures of being a TV reviewer is sometimes you're forced to watch things you would never, ever considered watching, which is why I've ended up watching 563 episodes of Escape to the Country. But the show I watched this week, which I really enjoyed, was Made in Italy, which is on SBS On Demand. It's this period drama, but it's set in the 1970s, about a young girl who goes to work on a women's fashion magazine and how that sort of opens up her world. There are scenes that are taken directly from The Devil Wears Prada, but it doesn't matter. It's just so beautiful to look at. Everyone's wearing a lot of brown. It runs the Caramello Koala gamut of browns, from dark chocolate to caramel. The hair's big and frizzy. The accents are beautiful. And it's just a really nice little 1 hour's bit of escapism. It's about sort of, you know, the birth of Italian fashion in the 1970s, how they decided to back themselves. And it bloomed into Missoni and all that wonderful stuff. So highly recommended. Let's get back to Game Time.
Okay, back to Mastermind. Michael's chosen prisoner, or as it was called outside Australia, Prisoner Cell Block H.
Yes.
It's an Australian television soap that ran from 1979 to 1986, following the lives of inmates and staff at a women's prison, the Wentworth Detention Centre. Are you ready, Michael?
I'm ready.
Who sang the theme song On the Inside?
You're going to have to try harder than this. Lynn Hamilton.
Correct. Next question. Who is the longest serving character on the show, appearing from episode 1 all the way through to the final episode, number 692?
I'm going to say it's Meg Jackson, later Meg Morris, played by Elspeth Ballantyne.
Correct. Next question. Who spoke the final line at the end of the series? I'm going to be the oldest biker in the world, Lurch, the oldest biker in the world.
The line has been spoken, in that scene is spoken by Rita Connors, who is the sort of the final top dog of Wentworth.
You're correct. Do you want to go for a bonus point on the actress who played Rita Connors?
Oh, Glenda Linscott. That's easy. You don't have to. Don't give me a bonus
point. Come on.
But it's Glenda Linscott. It's Glenda Linscott. She was very good.
Glenda Linscott. Yes, you're correct, Michael. Question four. On Thursday, the 13th of February, 1986, which legendary US entertainer arrived by helicopter at the Nunawading Studios to visit the show's set, where he met the cast and declared his adoration for the character of Joan Ferguson, played by Maggie Kirkpatrick?
I know this only because I'm so old that I remember the TV Week story. Sammy Davis Jr.
Correct. It was Sammy Davis Jr.
Oh, thank gosh, yeah.
It's for all. Ooh, okay,
don't
Michael.
Get this wrong, Michael. Game's on the line.
This is for the win. Before Anne Charleston played Madge Bishop, the matriarch of the Ramsay family in Neighbours, she also appeared in Prisoner. How many characters did she play and can you name them?
Okay, so I'm going to be really geeky and say on at least one occasion, I'm pretty sure she played like an unnamed policewoman, like an extra in a scene. But,
oh, my goodness.
The actual characters that she played, the first character she played, she was Mum Brooks' daughter, Lorraine, who had like basically didn't want to know her when she got out of prison. And then the second character she played was Reb Keane's mother. Was the other, I can't think of a name offhand, but Reb Keane was a prisoner played by Janet Andrewartha and Anne Charleston played her mother.
Wow. Oh my God. Her name, for your reference, was Deirdre.
Deirdre Keane.
Deirdre Keane, and you are correct, right down to unnamed policewoman, which is pretty extraordinary.
Oh, my God.
Wow. Michael, okay. I believe, is
mess.
Our winner with
an
admirable 5 out of 5. Congratulations, oh, Michael.
Thank you.
Yeah, you put me up against the king there. That was the Michael's like top dog question.
That was
anyway, Michael, well done. Debbie, great job on being mistress of Mastermind today. Well done. We'll put you back in the hot seat next time. Michael, as always, you're a freak. Guys, thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch up with you next time. If you like the podcast, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app, and please rate and review us. You can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael Adado, and Debbie is at Debbie Enker, and you can find me at Lou_Ruge. You can also read stories by Michael, Debbie, or myself on the mastheads of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. We'll catch up with you next time on The Televisionaries. The Televisionaries is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. It's hosted by myself, Louise Rugendyke. It was created and executively produced by Life Editor Monique Farmer and Culture Editor Matt Burgess. The podcast is produced by LapFan, and our Head of Audio is Tom McKendrick. The Nine Network is the owner of this podcast and the streaming service Stan.